Hi, I'm Ahmed Shahabuddin, sitting in for Femi Oke, and you're in the stream. Since the war between Israel and Palestine in May, there has been an undeniable shift in public support for Palestinians. But will it lead to any real change? If you're watching us on YouTube, join the conversation, share your thoughts in our live chat, and you too will be in the stream. After the latest escalation in violence in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, a growing number of people in the U.S. believe the government should be putting more pressure on Israel. For the first time ever, a majority of Democrats, 53%, want to see more pressure on the Israelis. That's up from 43% in 2018. And these numbers are seeing an extra large bump among liberal and progressive youth. Now, last month, the United Kingdom's Labour Party passed a motion labeling Israel an apartheid state, following in the footsteps of leading human rights groups such as Israel's B'Tselem and Human Rights Watch. Here's Olivia Cotby-Smith of the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement.
The global solidarity with Palestinian liberation since May has been unprecedented and has reached new heights. And this is really due to several key factors. One of them is that Palestinian unity across historic Palestine and the diaspora has really been historic in challenging colonial fragmentation. Another factor is that the BDS movement and our global partners have been working on planting these seeds of solidarity for many years. Another factor is that Israel's steady shift to the far right, its alliances with fascist parties and dictatorships, has resulted in it losing the liberal mainstream, along with its exportation of weapons and surveillance and violations of human rights in Palestine and globally.
Here to discuss that growing solidarity in New York, Mohammed Al-Kurd. He's an award-winning writer and poet from Jerusalem, occupied Palestine. In Brooklyn, Linda Sarsour. She's the executive director of Empower Change, a mass movement of diverse U.S. Muslims and allies fighting for a future free from Islamophobia and white supremacy. And last but not least, in London, rapper and campaigner Lowkey joins us as well. Welcome to the stream. So pleased to have you all with us. Mohammed, I want to get straight to it. Earlier this summer, I saw you appear on MSNBC, and you explained that this is the second time you're being thrown out of your home by Israeli settlers. I think your father's third time, and if your grandmother was alive, I think it'd be her fourth or fifth time. Now, you then asked whether U.S. taxpayers really want to be spending $3.8 billion for the demolition of your home during a pandemic while so many Americans are struggling. Since then, it's been difficult not to notice that you've gained hundreds of thousands of followers on social media. The world certainly seems to be paying more attention. What do you think is behind this renewed attention and the shift in perception, specifically in the U.S., but also across the world?
Thank you so much, Ahmed, for having me. I think, you know, there was and continues to be in my lifetime a hunger to listen to Palestinian voices on the ground, to understand the Palestinian perspective that merely reflects the material reality of the Zionist and Israeli aggression that we face as Palestinians. And so when Palestinians started taking on to social media, this apparently nuanced, complex, micro, hard-to-digest issue became actually a pretty easy-to-understand issue, became a pretty easily identifiable problem of colonization, of a colonizer versus a colonizer, problem of a settler from, Long Island coming to a Palestinian home in Sheikh Jarrah. It became a pretty easy to understand. And I think this resulted in a huge shift of perception of narrativizing in the streets. Now, I think we also need to be pushing for an institutional shift, right? This shift in the streets needs to translate systemically. Governments at large, not just the United States government, are not respecting or reflecting their citizens' wishes of pressuring and sanctioning the Israeli occupations, of tending to their own personal needs, be it healthcare or a better education or clean water in the case of Flint.
Yeah, Mohammed, you raised the priority perspective. Linda, do you agree with Mohammed? Anything to add as to what's really at the crux of this shift? And is it a significant shift, in your opinion?
Absolutely, it's a significant shift. I think what's behind it also is social media. It's about not being able to deny the stories directly coming from those who are the most directly impacted. It's about playing to people's values and principles. And when people see, and you ask somebody here in New York a question and say, hey, What would you do if somebody just came to your home and literally tried to forcefully remove you? People were like, this is unjust. This is unacceptable. And finding the storytellers has been important, the messengers. Mohammed and his sister and many other activists in Palestine have been wonderful messengers for this. I always tell people all the time, while I am a Palestinian and very proud to be that, I am a Palestinian American who does not live under a military occupation, and mm-hmm. we need to lift the voices of those that are on the ground. So social media and seeing the videos, you can't deny what your eyes see. It's no longer a, you know, through a third party. It's literally you and the injustice. And you start asking yourself, what side do I want to be on? And I think majority of Americans are starting to think and say, you know what? I don't want to be on the side of aggression. I don't want to be on the side of a nation state that forcibly removes people from their homes and militarizes communities and terrorizes young people and elders. And that has been very important. And I think the media, then the traditional media, has been forced into telling the story the way it should be told, because social media has set the precedent and the framework. And anything that diverges from that is obviously not going to be an accurate depiction of what's happening.
Right. And you know, Loki, I heard Linda reference social media as having played a pivotal role. Now, obviously, the occupation, the ethnic cleansing, apartheid policies have been around for decades. Social media has been around for, what, two decades now. So it's not like it's new. And I know that you're a little bit more apprehensive about this sort of tech utopian view. That said, I do want to quickly ask you, Loki, on the back of this tweet from AJ Plus, chronicling some of what happened. For as much as there was a big shift on social media, Facebook and Instagram also suppressed posts about Israeli human rights abuses. We've seen hundreds of posts deleted. We've seen Instagram falsely tagging posts as hate speech and then apologizing and calling it a glitch. We've seen a lot of accusations about who owns these platforms and what their agendas are. Loki, what do you think is the role of social media? Was it significant? Is it just social media that made this shift?
Well, while I agree completely that the key hypocrisy of Zionism, as Yusuf al-Kabir, an Iraqi lawyer of Jewish background in the 1930s, described it as a form of militant archaeology, has been seen clearly by the world, we also do have to remember that the Palestinian Prisoner Studies Center found that between 2015 and 2018, 500 Palestinians were arrested, and many of them were children, for Facebook posts. So what we've seen is an extension of that carried out in terms of the involvement of former employees of Unit 8200 in Israeli military intelligence mm-hmm. in organizations like Facebook, Google. This has been counted and documented by a journalist by the name of Whitney Webb, who found mm-hmm. these former employees of this key part of the infrastructure of surveillance of the Israeli government in these companies.
Right.
And so one has to question, why is it that we saw this almost deletion and erasure of, or attempts to erase, the Palestinian narrative during this recent uprising?
Right.
What was the reason? What was the ins and outs of it? And also, we've seen an unprecedented amount of employees within these organizations speaking out, signing petitions, and actually in the last uprising on the verge of strike
right.
over this anti-Palestinian bias which exists within these corporations. So it's a double-edged
right.
sword,
right.
of course.
Most definitely. And Mohammed, I saw you were nodding, and it was almost like you wanted to jump in after Loki. I want to quickly go to two tweets, one from Peter Beinart, because I think there's also been a reckoning or a confrontation or a reflection amongst certain Jewish peoples, Jewish leaders, certain Zionist organizations, maybe not as much as there should be. But Peter Beinart writing here on Twitter, the reason the American debate over Israel-Palestine could shift dramatically and quickly is that many Democratic politicians don't need to be convinced that what Israel is doing is wrong. They just need to be convinced that they can say so without hurting their careers. Now, Mohammed, here's another a tweet from you saying the appropriate term to describe Israeli attacks on Palestinians is in fact settler violence. When you think of Peter's tweet about politicians needing to know that there's not going to be a fallout, and this idea of what's appropriate, is it appropriate? You know, I remember when I started in journalism, not only was it inappropriate for a politician to say that, but at the New York Times, at these big news organizations, including The Wire, you would never say occupied West Bank. You would never hear the term ethnic cleansing being used just a decade ago. What are your thoughts about Peter's tweet, and what do you think What do you think is the reason we're seeing terminology being more aptly used?
Well, I think politicians and journalists really need to get a grip on reality and understand that whatever backlash they might receive, whatever career might be hurt, is never going to be as difficult as the reality that Palestinians live under materially. And I think, you know, when we ask people to use terms like occupation, like colonialism, like ethnic cleansing, we are asking them not to do us a favor, but to be objective. These words are not hypothetical. These words are not theoretical. They are carved into my body. I feel them and experience them every single day, as do millions of Palestinians, and have continued to feel them for over 70 years. This ethnic cleansing is not a metaphor, and it's not a propaganda word that we are using, but it is in fact proven, and it is actually advocated for explicitly within the Israeli authorities, through Israeli politicians, through their campaigns. This is not something that we are theorizing about. Of course, I do not need to cite Israeli politicians to make my point. I believe my experience and the experience of my people mm-hmm. is far more valuable than an assertion or a confirmation from mm-hmm. a racist Israeli politician. But I do think American politicians, American journalists, really need to assess the pain and heft of saying something that might cause backlash versus being right. under the grip of a bulldozer or on the other end of a rifle.
Mohammed, Linda's nodding as you're speaking. So is Loki. Linda, I want to come to you because, you know, we keep hearing from people, more and more voices, let's say, in Congress, as well as celebrities are speaking out about Palestine, right? And they're being bold. They're using bold terminology relative to what they used to use. Look at this tweet from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Apartheid states aren't democracies. You know, she has spoken at length about ethnic displacement and cleansing. And then recently we saw her vote present on a vote whether to fund Israel and send another $1 billion to Israel. And, you know, there's been a fallout. And I just want to know from you, I mean, for as much as we've seen a shift amongst the squad, and not just the squad, but others, what is the cost? I mean, why would Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez vote present when she's criticized other colleagues for doing the very same thing?
You know, Ahmed, I'm not here to speak on behalf of AOC. I think she has spoken on her own behalf and has tried to explain her position. And to be clear, I'm not going to always agree with AOC or Ilhan or Rashida or mm-hmm. Jamal Bowman or many others that we consider to be in the squad. What we're seeing here is people committed to a long-term game. I do not believe that we are going to shift U.S. foreign policy on Palestine within one congressional kind of session. Mm-hmm. It's going to take long-term work. But what we have seen is that for those that worry that Palestine could potentially hurt their careers, we've seen it actually help in other instances. You know, Jamal Bowman, he literally beat one of the most pro-Zionist, pro-Israel members of Congress that this country has ever seen in Elliot Engel, who had millions of dollars mm-hmm. in his campaign war chest. We watched Cori Bush in St. Louis, Missouri, literally beat Lacey Clay, who was a very strong ally to the state of Israel. And he had been in Congress for many decades. In fact, his father was also a member of Congress. And so while we may not be seeing the kind of, policy change that we want right now, we are seeing a conversation that is literally at the top of the Democratic Party in a way that it hasn't ever been before. And what we're seeing is that the pro-Palestine movement in the United States of America has become a lot more influential, mm-hmm. and our movements have become a lot more intersectional. So you will see the larger kind of Black Lives Matter racial justice movements in America
right.
who have kind of integrated Palestine as part of their platform. As we talk about refugees and we talk about immigration, mm-hmm. seeing the issue of Palestine and seeing what is happening in Palestine and making those comparisons. When we talk about police brutality and policing in America, making those comparisons between the militarization and the ways in which police act in Israel as right. they do here in the United States and those training programs. And we're watching the kind of BDS movement grow with a Christian-based sect here in the United States who are divesting from Israel, watching universities
right.
do the same, watching corporations
right.
like Ben and Jerry's, who, you know, didn't go all the way, but they went some way. And that was because of the growing movements here in the United States.
Do those things encourage you, Mohammed, as someone who lives this, as someone who lives the consequences of this brutal occupation? Do those, you know, when you hear John Legend, when you hear celebrities, when you hear authors, when you hear more people standing up, does it give you hope that things are going to change on the ground? Are things changing on the ground?
I mean, I believe the change that has happened over the course of how many decades is a cumulative change, and it is the result and the factor of many, many, many movements and organizations and individuals working tirelessly and risking their careers and sacrificing their lives. I will say, however, that yes, of course, things like this give me hope, but they always end up being in the category of symbolic solidarity, of symbolic change, while systemically, we're not seeing much different on the ground. For example, this uprising that we saw that has inspired hundreds of thousands of people globally, today we are seeing that the people who participated in it are being punished within a violent crackdown. There are thousands of Palestinians that are being shoved into prison and handed lengthy sentences. My own neighbor, Murad Atiyah, a 25-year-old elementary school teacher, has been charged, and God knows for how long he's going to stay in prison because of his role in the Save Sheikh Jarrah campaign, the campaign that hundreds of thousands of people endorsed, the campaign that many foreign governments and diplomats endorsed.
Right.
We are paying the price for it. So I think it's really important to translate this solidarity, this positive change, this sentiment into tangible action that will help our people instead of leaving them behind, especially those of us who do not have that visibility.
No, I appreciate you mentioning that last point. And Loki, I see that you're nodding. You know, for those of you who don't know in our audience, last week, Irish author Sally Rooney rejected a bid by an Israeli publishing house to translate her latest novel into Hebrew, citing her support for the BDS movement, saying, "I simply do not feel it would be right for me under the present circumstances to accept a new contract with an Israeli company that does not publicly distance itself from apartheid and support the UN stipulated rights of the Palestinian people." Loki, when you see these kinds of things happening, I'm curious, is this encouraging? Because I saw your tweet saying more important than Sally Rooney is the 400 employees of Google and Amazon that signed a letter demanding their employees stop Project Nimbus, which entails them working with the IDF to build a new cloud service. Are these things encouraging on their own? What more needs to happen to do exactly what Mohammed said and what Linda referred to, which is translate this into real policy change or change on the ground?
The reason I said that is that BDS will come from the bottom up. Organizations like the Democrats, actually, and it's important to note that they have received more funding since 1989 to now than the Republicans have from pro-Israel lobbyists. They have received $104 million at least from pro-Israel lobbyists. This is congresspeople within the Democrats, in contrast to the Republicans, who have received $66 million at least from pro-Israel lobbyists. We also have to remember that when you look at what happened during that time, you saw the Biden administration agreeing to sell $735 million worth of weapons in the midst of the Israeli campaign in Gaza, after they knocked down the tower which housed Al Jazeera. And simultaneous to that, you had Italian dock workers refusing to load ships with weapons that were to be sent to the Israeli state.
Right.
You had Palestine Action in London close down an Elbit Systems factory for 6 consecutive days. And the Fire Brigades Union issue a statement refusing to remove those protesters from the factory at the same time as Google employees were on the verge of revolt. So what we're talking about here is BDS coming from the bottom up, and these established organizations largely acting as internal surveillance systems and acting to squash BDS time and time again.
Mohammed, did you have something to add?
I mean, I agree completely. I think, you know, a point that we often make is that the U.S. sends the Israeli occupation $3.8 billion a year in military aid. And I think the strategy should be not appealing or performing to Congress people, but really talking to grassroots organizers, talking to the American people themselves, to place their politicians and representatives under pressure to hold them accountable to this, because we are not going to ever get sympathy, let alone political action, from people who are orchestrating occupations and massacres within their own right, independently of the Israeli occupation.
No, that's true. And Linda, I want to kind of ask you something. I noticed that there was a myriad of articles from people who grew up in Zionist households, in the Washington Post, in the New York Times, during the latest escalation of violence, where I saw essentially a kind of reckoning, a reflection among some people about, you know, essentially being brainwashed as young Jewish people about what the history is, the actual facts, you know, in an era where facts didn't seem to matter. For example, one that stood out to me is this piece in the Washington Post called "Zionism Cannot Produce a Just Peace, Only External Pressure Can End the Israeli Apartheid." It's by Raphael Mimoun. He said his Jewish community was fed a historical narrative divorced from reality. The narrative being that during what we call Israel's War of Independence, Palestinians were not expelled by Jewish militias, but instead willingly left their homes to make room for Arab armies to push all the Jews into the sea, dead or alive. The Arab leaders were never interested in compromising, turning down peace offers from Israel and the United States one after the other. So all these narratives that he's discrediting in the piece really, really reflect to me maybe that there's something happening on that side of things. Let's take a look at a video comment that he sent us.
What we're seeing in the United States right now is something we haven't seen before in terms of the public opinion shifting, especially among young people, on the issue of Israel and Palestine. And I think that has a lot to do with social media, because people have access to Palestinian stories directly from Palestinians, uncensored, unfiltered. And that feeds into the movements that everyone or a lot of people here in the United States are fighting in. Movements for racial justice, for social justice, for indigenous rights, for trans rights, for the environment. And there is a realization that we can't be fighting for Black lives here and ignore Palestinian lives there.
Linda, he ends his article with, "The only thing that can bring about Palestinian liberation is if the cost of the occupation begins to outweigh its benefits." What do you make of his comments there?
I think he reflects kind of a new generation of Jewish Americans, many of whom have been taught that Zionism is a political movement to build a safe haven for the Jewish people. And the arguments made to young Jewish Americans is that there has to be a justification for that safe haven, and then they learn what those are, which is the destabilization, the removal of Palestinians, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, a military occupation, a siege on Gaza, and all of a sudden these young Jewish Americans don't want anything to do with that. As just humans in general, we want safe havens for all people. Everyone deserves to live with safety and security, but we should never have to do that at the expense of another people. Mm-hmm. And that's important, and it's growing. I mean, one of the biggest myths in the United States, and there's a lot of times where Zionist organizations and right-wing pro-Israel organizations try to pin us up against each other. And I think we have a new generation. And actually, there are some, I would call, seasoned folks and elders in the Jewish community who have been co-founders of groups like Jewish Voice for Peace and other organizations who have come and stood in solidarity with the Palestinian people, who say, no occupation in my name, you know, no dehumanization of Palestinian people in my name. And that's important. And it's an important part of the conversation, because what I will say is that in order for us to truly transform and translate our kind of solidarity here, as Mohammed and Loki talked about, we need everybody. Our liberation is intertwined, which is why it's important for Palestinians to be part of the larger racial justice movements, pro-immigrant rights movements in the United States, because at the end of the day, it's going to need all of us to free Palestine and ensure the freedom and the liberation of the Palestinian people.
Mohammed, very quickly before we wrap, here's a tweet from you talking about the latest crackdown on journalists. Of course, we've seen journalists shot, targeted, brutalized, and arrested in Jerusalem and beyond in the occupied West Bank. I myself, as a journalist, have been beaten by Israeli soldiers, have been targeted. Mohammed, what do you want to say to Americans who watch this and feel disaffected?
Well, you know, also, I'll tie this to the earlier conversation. I think, you know, we all know that these narratives, these Zionist narratives, the racist anti-Palestinian Zionist narratives that we want to throw people into the sea, or that we were non-existent, or that we were created in the 60s, were false. But even if they were true, let me say this. Narratives of hypothetical bigotry do not equate, let alone justify, real, material, state-sponsored, systemic violence against Palestinians. Well, and there is an abundance proof of that.
And on that note, it's where we're going to have to wrap this conversation. Unfortunately, we will have to end it here on TV. We are going to continue online for just a couple moments. A big thank you to our guests and our community for joining today's discussion. Until next time, we'll see you online. Thanks for joining us.